You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Welcome, everyone, to another Damn Fine Cup of Culture, Second Chances Edition. This is where we go back to that movie or those movies that we maybe hated with a passion, wanted to forget right away, or simply didn't get what the fuss was all about. Yet over the years, we had that nagging feeling that maybe we should try again and see what was wrong with it and if we feel different this time. And joining me for today's discussion about two movies is Alan. Welcome, Alan.
Hello.
Alan, we actually will talk about two films today that are by the same director. A famous one, a cult movie director, some would say. Someone with a prolific output, David Fincher. And maybe just because we talk about two Fincher films, Alan, do you generally have an issue with Fincher and his movies?
Not really. I think what sort of motivated me to pick the film I picked is that I was a very big Fincher fan. And then coming to this film, I went to the cinema to see it, very excited, and in the cinema had quite a strong reaction to it, quite a strong negative reaction to it. And I've never seen it since. And I just thought, enough time has passed now, over a decade has passed. It's probably time just to give it another chance. So it was very much sort of the issue I have with Fincher almost starts with this film. Before it, I would be sort of a Fincher film was something I would go to the cinema, and I think there's quite a run of films of his that I'd really enjoyed in the cinema. So that's one of the reasons why I was definitely up for giving it a second chance, because I know he can do good films.
Interesting. I think the same issue came up with me, but earlier on in Fincher's career, because we're going to talk about a film first that is 10 years before the one you will talk about in more detail. But I was just thinking, like, the way Fincher came up for me in the 90s when I was kind of becoming a movie geek and, you know, catching up on all kinds of franchises. I remember hearing about Alien 3, of course, also watching the Alien movie. So that's the first time I heard about David Fincher, and people said, you know, he's very promising, such a great, at least visual entry into the series. And then Seven came up and we were all big fans of Seven. We loved it. We talked about it. This was kind of our perfect thriller, and we were kind of following David Fincher then into The Game, another very stylish thriller, and that we really enjoyed as well. And then for me came the movie that we're going to talk about first, Fight Club, cult classic by now, and many people really loved it from the start. I didn't at all. And I think let's start a discussion here. Did you see Fight Club at the cinema as well? How did it sit with you when you saw it?
I mean, actually, strangely, this was one I did see in the cinema, and it was very hyped beforehand. And I'd really enjoyed Seven, so I was quite excited to see it. The hype was incredible. People were saying this is the sort of greatest film. It's a whole new talent. And so I think there was an element on my initial reaction where I was all that hype, and I was like, well, it's not quite that good. You know, if people tell you before you go see a film, it's going to be the greatest thing ever, I always think it's not quite fair on the film. Because a film can be a good film, but what your initial reaction is sort of disappointment that it's not the greatest thing ever. But I remember sort of enjoying it, but initially that disappointment. And then definitely related to that sort of cult vibe, I was living in like shared housing with friends. We'd go to the video store and we used to get out films, and Fight Club was a frequent rental. It wouldn't necessarily be my choice, but it became one that got rented a number of times. And I enjoyed rewatching it. I think there was a lot in it that I just sort of enjoyed, the sort of visual flair, sort of just sort of a level of inventiveness about it that you can enjoy in the rewatch without necessarily having to be like sitting there thinking, well, this better be the best film ever made. So you know, it's sort of weirdly, I guess, but you know, once I'd measured my expectations, I thought this is a good film. I mean, in your rewatch, did your take change on it?
Well, I was very split even the second time round. I remember hating it with a passion when it came out at the cinema. I was put off by the violence, kind of the senselessness of that violence. I didn't see what the film was trying to say with this expression of violence, whether it was just trying to, you know, be cool about these men fighting it off. And was it really necessary to be so graphic? I remember people were enthralled at the end by the great twist the fact that we find out that actually one character in the film, I think, you know, I hope I don't spoil that for anyone too much.
It came out so long ago. If people don't know the twist,
I think we're safe. Yeah. We're safe. The fact that one character, Brad Pitt, doesn't really exist, but just exists in the mind of Edward Norton character. I remember really not caring about that anymore because I hadn't liked the film so much. So it really put me off Fincher for a while. And I think the fact that I didn't go to see Fincher's films afterwards so regularly, I always put back to how I disliked Fight Club. So I really went into this one with a lot of hesitation and a lot of, unwillingness even. And I must say, my rewatch confirmed that I really didn't like or don't like watching this film. It's an unpleasant film to watch for me from start to finish. And I think it's partly the violence and the way this is even feeling today in comparison to other films that portray kind of coolness and fights and violence. But I think it's also that it's a kind of an annoying watch with the Edward Norton character at the center. These incessant voiceovers that start from the very beginning and then his kind of path into insomnia and trying to kind of get a hold of that, finding a way out of this. It's very unpleasant to watch, but I must say it gave me a lot to think about afterwards. It was a film that then, contrary to 1999, really lingered with me. And I thought about a lot of issues that the movie brings up. And also, and that's a question I had to you, what the violence means. Is it really meaningless? And how does it sit with, you know, audiences today? I had a lot of connections that I made to, you know, what does this film mean? Or what did it mean in the 90s? And what does it mean for us today, seeing all these men fighting it out and really getting some satisfaction from that?
I mean, I do think it's interesting that it's not a film that I think has a lot of depth, which is probably, again, why my initial reaction in the cinema was probably more sort of measured disappointment, I think, because I was expecting so much more. And I do think it's interesting that the twist at the end was one of the reasons why I was underwhelmed initially, because it's not that clever a twist. It's a little bit gimmicky. It doesn't really completely, it's more M. Night Shyamalan. It's just, here's something you didn't see coming. Ooh, isn't it interesting? And I don't think it really says anything. It's more on a level of gimmick. And you sort of come away thinking, well, you were just throwing gimmicks at me. And so I think where I sort of enjoyed the rewatch is, again, or even rewatches sort of when it was out on VHS, was just, okay, don't take it seriously. Resign yourself to there isn't a huge amount of depth to this, and just sort of enjoy the visual feast. And I think that is very much the level of my enjoyment of the film. Is I think it's incredibly stylishly shot. I think Fincher reminds me a lot of Ridley Scott, and it's the same issue with Ridley Scott in the sense that they really understand striking, beautiful images, and to some extent how to shoot a scene that imbues it with motion, that you're really compelled to go through to the end of the scene, you know, the sort of dynamics of it. But there's not much there. I think that they maybe take themselves too seriously as directors, but they have a sort of level of directing talent that I think is undeniable. And I think in the very modern context, rewatching it for this podcast was that just seems to be magnified over time, because there's a level of violence now. You know, I've seen so much since that you start getting into the world of, you know, the French film Titain recently, that there's films that do visceral much stronger now, that it just sort of becomes, oh, this is stylishly visual. And if you're mentally ready for it, you know, it's going to be very violent. It has a sort of superficially beautiful quality to the violence. It's not real violence. You never get the impression that this is what it would be like if just two guys were fighting. This is a very cinematic, dynamic, stylish way of portraying blood and masculinity. And it's kind of fun for that, but I don't think it has much to say about that.
I'm really glad, Alan, that you say that, because I was kind of struggling with that. Am I to see more depth in this that I actually see? am I, you know, too quickly put off by the graphic quality of the images? Is Fincher really trying to say something more here? And I did have the impression with a number of Fincher films over the years as well that I admire the filmmaking. I admire in this film particularly also how advanced the visual effects were, like the digital visual effects already. I was watching this and thought, this is a film from 1999, and it looks so good in places. Mm. It's so well made. I'm thinking of this IKEA animated sequence, for instance. And I thought, oh, wow, this really looks great considering when the film was made. But with Fincher, I often had this feeling of excellent filmmaking, but I don't quite get the depth of this. And with Fight Club, I think I was struggling in particular. For me, I was more thinking of how does it sit with audiences post 9/11? You know, just a few years later, there were these, you know, terrorist attacks, or also, I guess, domestic terrorism. How does it sit post January 6th, 2021, when you see that, you know, people or groups of men and women willing to, you know, fight against the political system, putting up a show of violence in a way that is boundless? So is that somehow also an effect of movies like Fight Club, or like you say, the fact that we have seen so much graphic violence over the years, inspired by films like Fight Club that made it seem kind of cool and stylish? So I was thinking of, you know, how does the film sit with audiences after 10, 20 years since it came out? But maybe that's giving it a bit too much credit of what it actually means in the context of the film.
I mean, I suppose what I would say is sort of a parallel is that this very much feels like enjoyable in the way that a very sort of 90s record, a 90s cool record that everyone at the time was buying and saying, oh, you know, you must get Nirvana's Nevermind or something, that it has a sort of cultural impact, and it's very influential, and it does last, but also it's not necessarily the greatest record ever. So as time progresses, it still becomes, I think, very much emblematic of that period. So this sort of feels to me like a very 1999 film. And I also think that it's very hard, especially given I think it's quite a superficial film, to sort of think that it's going to have much of an impact beyond that. I do think the film industry actually isn't that influenced by real life events as maybe it even thinks it is. I think, you know, that we have had sort of, yeah, 9/11 especially. I mean, you do have a moment at the very end when buildings are collapsing that it has a sort
exactly.
of visual.
Yes.
But that doesn't last long, and I don't think it changes how you see the film. It's a stylish image. It remains a stylish image. I imagine if 9/11 was a lot closer to you, maybe it would make the film, you know, you'd need a bit of a trigger warning. But it just feels like Hollywood just carries on. There's a market for this kind of film, and you find that with violent action films, that they haven't really, they don't end just because there's a lot of violence in the real world. They just seem to sort of trundle along because it doesn't impact that much on films. I mean, I would be interested if someone was sort of 18 or 19 watching this now, whether that cool would translate. And I think it would probably be a bit akin to an 18, 19-year-old listening to Nirvana's Nevermind. And some of them would say, this is really cool. And a lot would be like, this sounds very old. You know, and I think that probably is how the sort of modern-day engagement with this film would be.
And I guess it goes into the discussion of how much is a film even able, or a cultural phenomenon like this film, able to influence real life behavior. I read a little bit about, you know, Fight Club springing up in the wake of this film. And of course, that leads us maybe then to speculate that this will have an influence on the culture of violence in the wake of the film. But I think the film is also an interesting take. That's the other aspect that I looked at this or thought about is what it speaks of the world at the time. I mean, it's a film so heavily quoted. So many things are said from this film. And I was particularly taken in by a quote about history and war and depression that Brad Pitt used in the film, where he says, you know, we don't have a great war in our generation. We don't have a great depression. Our war is somewhat the one we're fighting in now, kind of making sense of the senselessness, and our depression is the one we're living through now in the modern world. And I think that struck a chord to me with the 1990s, maybe this empty decade somewhere between Cold War and, you know, what's going to happen now. And maybe this film sat so well with audiences or has sat so well in the meantime, because it speaks of that moment in time.
Mm.
And many felt that it was very, yeah, timely. And maybe that's not what Fincher exactly intended, but that's certainly the way it was read, it seems.
And definitely there's a question that I have, which is, I remember at the time and the years after it having that cult-like quality. Like I said, there were like Fight Club set up, and I think it was seen very much as a sort of zeitgeist film, for the reasons you've given. But is it still a cult? Is it, interestingly, something that had its period as a cult film, resonated sort of in the early 2000s, but is actually now one of those cult films that almost its cult has dwindled? It's a cult film for a very small number of people, whereas there was a time where it was a cult film with quite a large cult following. And I guess I'm not the person that, you know, understands what a lot of people are into these days, but its representation in the culture does seem to have disappeared. It doesn't seem to have lasted as a cultural touchstone in the way that people probably thought at the time that it would. I do wonder if you talk to people getting into films in their early 20s now, whether Fight Club is part of the conversation.
Good question. Good question. I don't think I've heard many people younger than I am talk much about Fight Club. It's really a thing that many people my age were very much into, or like me, were not at all, or were put off by. So I don't see that really happening with Fight Club. It's different from, let's say, Tarantino, or I'm also thinking of the Coen brothers. Films that I also hear, for instance, my student talk about, you know, The Big Lebowski or Pulp Fiction. Those are still movies that I think resonate more, that also over-stylize violence in a certain way. And that's, I think, still is very, very popular among teenagers and people in their 20s, 30s as well. I thought about that as well, because, of course, at the same time, I was watching films like Reservoir Dogs or Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. Tarantino in general, also films that seem to really exaggerate scenes of violence and stylize violence in a particular way. I also didn't like most of these movies, but I did come to appreciate, especially Tarantino, over the years much more. Whereas with Fincher, it's a very much hot or cold kind of thing. And watching Fight Club, I must say, the second time round, I still don't like it. I still find it's an unpleasant watch. But what's your take on Tarantino and Co. in comparison to Fight Club?
I think what really is the sort of striking difference, and where sort of Fight Club maybe does lack something, is again, the violence in the 90s that lasted. This is going to sound a weird way of putting it, but it has a real sense of fun. Tarantino films, when you were going to see them in the 90s, were fun. That, yeah, there's a lot of dark laughter at some of the violence. I'm thinking like Pulp Fiction, where he accidentally shoots the person because they go over a bump in the car. That is both horrible, and the cinema laughs when that happens. And there's an element to which you portray that violence, you play that very stylized violence as humor. That works. If you have very stylized violence that you think is trying to give you a message, it's sort of, this is serious, this has got an important point behind it, but you can't really spot the point, it does make a difference. I don't think it's as lasting, because you just have some nice visuals. You have, again, you don't see them now, but I remember there'd be like posters at the time of, you know, Brad Pitt heavily beaten, you know, topless and bleeding. That was quite an image of the time, and that image you don't see so much anymore. It's that seriousness that probably, again, has meant it doesn't last. Because, again, going to the Coen brothers, there's some horrible violence in Miller's Crossing. It has moments that are generally quite shocking, but also funny. It has a black comic side that, again, I've seen Miller's Crossing in the cinema, and the cinema laughs at really quite horrible moments. And that does seem to me, in the way that 90s handled violence, it's the entertainment that seems to have worked. And when they tried to handle violence and gone, we've got an important message here, I think people just, we're not in the mood for that. We're not sort of interested in that as a take on extreme cinematic violence.
And it's always, that's so interesting, because I was trying to watch Fight Club, and after a few minutes I thought, well, maybe I'm not to take this seriously. maybe there is a level of fun in this as well, because I thought maybe I just hadn't seen that when I first saw it. Maybe I just thought, you know, disgusting violence, I'm put off. And for a while I thought, well, there is some, at least some cynicism to it. If I think of the role that Meatloaf plays, for instance, in the film, and it does make you laugh when Edward Norton meets him for the first time at this self-help group and he cries on his ample bosom at the beginning. And at the same time, I thought, well, this is not really funny. It's also kind of sad, a bit odd and a bit icky at the same time. And then he gets badly beaten up in the course of the film as well. And I lost track of where I should find the fun. There were moments where I thought, oh, this is supposed to be sarcastic, at least. There's a certain level of irony. But I didn't get it. There was no message or no take I was really sure, well, okay, this is also for fun. It also has this level of, it's violent, but it's also absurd in a way. But cynical at most, I thought. And that, of course, is not a very pleasant feeling and not something that probably lasts with audiences.
And I was just, in terms of sort of violence in films around that time, I actually recently, there was a rescreening, and I remembered going to see a film and really like being moved by it, and especially the violence, which is Gary Oldman's Nil by Mouth. And very much, I left that film and I don't think I can ever watch that film again because of the presentation of violence. It feels like a very realistic presentation of violence, like actual physical. If people are physically violent with each other, this is what it looks like. This is the consequences. And it is, like I said, it is shocking. And I don't think I could ever watch that film again. And it coming back to sort of being shown again recently, I saw it and I thought, I know that's a good film, but I can't make myself watch it again because of the violence at the heart of it, a sort of abusive, violent, drunk father. And especially if you see something like Fight Club after that, although it's grisly, although it's like cynical, it's also cartoony. It doesn't leave the impact that real world violence would have on you. And I think one of the things Nil by Mouth does is it gives you a sense, at least a small piece of, real world violence is traumatizing for this reason. And that, like I said, even that small taste means I cannot go see that film again because the violence is present in that way. Whereas nothing in Fight Club affects me in that sense because it's very visceral, but it's so stylized that you never think this is really what happens. You know, the people who, like I said, people may have started Fight Clubs after the film. They don't seem to be around now, probably because people very quickly realize that a real life Fight Club isn't as stylish and as glossy and as, you know, excitingly sexual as the violence in this film is. It is just going to be large blokes meeting each other.
But they were certainly hoping that it would
be. Yeah. I'll go to that Fight Club, that illegal Fight Club for real. And then I'll emerge with a photo of me looking like Brad Pitt in Fight Club. And, you know, they didn't. And so the real
life. He does look very good, I must say. So yeah. Maybe if you take that, if you mentioned the pictures that you saw of Brad Pitt at the time, maybe if that was, you know, your exercise goal to start a Fight Club and then look like Brad Pitt, maybe that worked out. But it would be interesting to have a report on where those Fight Clubs went, you know, how long they lasted. And
it feels like one of those memes where like someone would say the dream and then the reality, and the dream would be Brad Pitt in his sort of like, you know, Fight Club finery, and the reality is someone looking really miserable in a hospital while their mum comes to feed them food through a straw. And you kind of think the reality is never going to quite match up to the film, and it probably didn't last.
Or the reality could just be Edward Norton.
Yes,
you know. Yeah. Because that's very much so. I read somewhere that I think they even worked with that he was supposed to look more and more sickly, even though he thinks he feels very good at Fight Club, whereas Brad Pitt is supposed to look better and better over the course of the film. I was struck by something that you said as well, that the film is nihilistic, that it's not really about anything. And that would, of course, go into that statement as well, that in a way, it doesn't last because it's really not about much. It's about this nihilism. Mm. And maybe that would also lead to people who really liked it and thought this had some deeper meaning, and to sooner or later realize that maybe it doesn't. At least to me, it didn't. And I must say, if it hadn't been for this podcast, I wouldn't have watched it again. I put myself through it again. And I must say, it was almost as unpleasant. And I think I gave it a bit more effort to see more in it and to connect more to it. But I really didn't. I have to say, second chances given, but no great results coming from it. No reappreciation, really, despite the good effects. I think the good acting and generally an admirable sense of filmmaking and still. But maybe that's a good chance, Alan, to see if we can give the other movie a second chance as well that we were looking at for this podcast. You already introduced it in slightly vaguer terms at the beginning. We didn't actually mention what it was. Do you want to give us a bit of context to our second movie?
I mean, the second film for Second Chances is The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And as I sort of said at the beginning, I went to see this with high expectations and I properly hated it. I sort of sat there and it's such a long film that just doesn't do anything. And it has such a weird script that people speak like humans don't really speak. They have a weird quality of, you know, they'll say something wise or a homily and it's just sort of like, what? And I just couldn't at any point get engaged or involved with the film. It had the quality that Fincher has, that he is a good, this stylized director. It is constantly visually inventive and dynamic, but far more for me than Fight Club. It's propelling emptiness, that there's nothing at the heart of it. And I find that it's such a sort of bloated exercise in that. And I mentioned on the recent podcast we did of Blonde, I sometimes get the feeling that if directors don't quite know what's at the heart of what they do, they start throwing everything at it in the hope that it will give it meaning. And so this is full of what's really meant to be quite taken seriously, like very sort of, oh, there's an old woman dying during the Katrina hurricane. There's all these sort of scenes and moments that they want you to think this is important, but none of it is. None of it, I think, has any weight to it. And it's just a procession of, take this bit seriously, take this bit seriously, take this bit. And you're sitting there thinking, like, but this is fundamentally quite a silly film. And I can't engage in it. And the rewatch, I again, probably naively, think, like when I went into the cinema, I haven't rewatched it since seeing it in the cinema. And I thought, it is David Fincher. Maybe I will enjoy it this time. And it was exactly the same. It really felt like I don't understand what this film is. It just seems to be existing in front of me. And they're showing me visuals, none of which I care about or get engaged with at any time. And several times you virtually swear at the telly because it's saying, they're thinking they're making a very serious point. And you just think it's very pompous. And the sort of initial reaction to pomposity is to sort of like laugh at it. It's a film that frequently has moments like that. Yeah, it is a very pompous film in my view. I mean, what was your take on it?
Well, first of all, I must say that I hadn't really seen the full film before this time watching it, 2 hours and 45 minutes. I had read the short story with my students in class and then had like shown a couple of scenes and, you know, told them a little bit about the film, saying that it is very different and that the absurdity of making F. Scott Fitzgerald's short story into a 2 hour and 45 minute film. And we talked a little bit about that, but this was the first time I actually saw it. And I was curious because it's, you know, in Fincher's list of films, this seems to be kind of the one love story that is supposed to be also focusing on emotions mostly. And I was kind of curious to see how would Fincher deal with telling an emotional story. I was kind of intrigued by the basic setup of the reverse aging process and how that would play out. I was kind of interested in seeing, like you said, how he sets it in the present day, but then goes back through different stations in American history and how that will play out. But I wrote down noticeably a few times in my notes, what's the point? So many times I was like, yeah, it's careful, it's admirable filmmaking. I get that this is supposed to tell us all these different stations at which those two characters meet at different ages. And then at one point, they're almost the same age. And then, of course, the whole thing goes in reverse. But it seemed like pointless to me. Like, what was I supposed to feel? They're in love. They know of the inevitability of what's happening here. But what am I supposed to feel beyond kind of waiting for it to be over? It seemed like an exercise in, you know, in style. And I think that for Fincher would be quite typical as well to be fascinated by a certain concept as a basic idea, fascinated by it probably, but then not really thinking of what's that supposed to do with the audience sitting there and admiring the special effects and admiring this concept. But I guess that goes into what you said as well. What are we supposed to make of this?
I mean, I will say just one of my notes from the rewatch is almost like what you said with Fight Club. There's a lot to admire in the special effects. I was genuinely struck by how much they haven't dated or how effective they were, in the sense that I think I've watched a lot of much more recent stuff that have tried to do this with characters and they end up looking like a computer game cutscene. And I do think it's one of the things that Fincher does really well is that he's one of the few sort of modern directors that really cares about lighting, that really cares about giving a mood and a realistic quality to how a scene is shot. So it's stylized, but it doesn't look fake. And he's really good at that. And he's really good at that in this film. And it works with the special effects. So he's not just, oh, we'll get the science people to just put an old Brad Pitt in here. I think there's a lot of tricks involving the light, involving prosthetics, involving digital, that works in a way that much more recent films don't do. I think much more recent films are a bit lazy. So there's definitely, you can sort of admire the special effects, but again, you do feel that's all you're doing. There is no humanity to the special effects that is giving you a story that you care about. And that just seems sort of a fatal flaw for the film. And I think sort of this time round, I sort of really tried to get to grips with why I sort of just find this film just so sort of empty. And I think the main thing is you have this incredibly strange premise. You have this very odd, whimsical, or slightly mad setup. And I think to work, the film needs to embrace the madness. And if you tell a story, if you really go hard on the madness, the strangeness, then you will have serious and poignant moments that will come out of that. And part of, again, sort of going back to films from, you know, the sort of couple of decades we're covering here, if you look at something like Being John Malkovich, which does do that, which just absolutely embraces the craziness of the concept, but then by the end, you have a sort of poignant tale of someone who's lost, who's completely lost in only understanding what he wants. And it springs out of the creativity and madness of the basic premise. And the problem with Benjamin Button is they seem to like almost not trust the weirdness. And they go straight to being serious and poignant. And every scene is shot in a way that's meant to be serious and poignant. You're meant to feel like this has weight. And weirdly, because if everything is on that level, nothing has any seriousness and nothing has any weight, because you're just stuck on the same gear throughout the whole film. And then you suddenly realize, well, I'm actually watching what is quite a silly tale of an old man aging backwards. And it really has that sort of, it doesn't ever have fun with the idea, which I think it needs to then weirdly be a serious and poignant film. And I think that was sort of the fatal flaw.
Yeah, and it's so glossy and perfect. Every image seems so well composed. And as you said, the special effects are really astounding. But it's so slow moving as well.
Mm.
I thought the length obviously plays a role in this as well. But just every scene is just like very static as well. I didn't feel there was a big change between the different sequences. They're overly dramatic, overly romanticized as well. And often I didn't really feel that. Plus, for me, the special effects also sometimes got in the way, because sometimes I was just looking at Kate Blanchett's face or at Brad Pitt's face and thought, aha, what's the aging thing they're trying to do here and how have they achieved it? So it also took me out of the film a number of times, knowing that Fincher does great special effects, wondering, okay, how have they done this? When is the little old man now still the animated man, and when is it going to be Brad Pitt? And even though it was, you know, admirable to watch for the quality of the effects, it really didn't do anything with me emotionally. And like you said, it was meant to. I was supposed to have all these feelings for these characters, meeting at all these stages in life and meeting all these other characters who then had aged. And of course, feeling the tragedy of that and feeling the weight of that all the time. And I didn't. It doesn't make sense, you know, for Fincher to go so heavy on the effect of special effects, or let's say the emotional effect of special effects. I didn't, for instance, know that he was a special effects guy to begin with, you know, working on Star Wars and Indiana Jones. And somehow talking about these two movies, it makes me think, well, is that the main tool that he thinks he has to use in order to have a certain effect on the audience, is to create a marvelous trick on you? If you think of The Game or Seven, there are elements of that as well. But at least with those films, I thought there was a certain level of, yeah, they serve a different purpose. This is not the main attraction. And Benjamin Button certainly, story-wise, this is the main attraction. People probably went to see it to see, well, how are they going to do that? How are they going to make Brad Pitt look like an old baby or like an old man or like a very young man? And you get, you know, your money's worth. But what has it done to you at the end as a message, as a meaning? Not much.
Another thing I was disappointed with watching it is you have sort of quite an incredible moment at the start where it touches into this fable, the sort of backwards clock. The guy who built the back, which is shot in such an interesting way, the sort of hand cranked color film, like deliberately made to look dated and slightly scuzzy. And then actually, it's interesting that that sort of visual fun and invention disappears. And it does look great, but if you're thinking about the fact that this is a film that covers a huge area of like the 20th century, which when you are there has a lot of different visual styles, it seems bizarre that it doesn't embrace that. It actually visually looks very similar all the way through. There's a consistent visual style to it, which just seems like, why would you do that when you're in the 60s? Think of, you know, pop culture, visual style in the 60s. You've got someone traveling through it that, you know, you can have a sort of earnest 40s setting. But what about when you move on to a different age? Like the beginning moment sets up that this is a film that will have fun with the visuals, with the media, with the presentation. And then I don't know why whether he thought this film is too serious. We can't do that. It then becomes this very, it's a very striking, but it's a very consistent film. And it's quite hard sometimes to get a sense of where you are in time in the world. It kind of all meant, oh, we're now at war, or we're now in the 60s. But there's a lot that it looks the same to every other era. Oh, we're in another hotel lobby with another sort of classically beautiful woman. There isn't much to really say we are traveling through such an interesting period of time with a guy that's going backwards. That seems there's so much you could do with that. And it doesn't do any of it. It really says, no, what we're interested in is a story of Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett's sort of lifelong romance, a couple that I feel have no chemistry in this whatsoever. At no point do I think this is two people really in love in a way, which, I mean, it's really hard for both of them because a lot of their time together, where they are on their character arc, means it's impossible to sort of capture that sort of romantic feeling of love. So early on in the film, you've got the sort of very aged, you know, you've got the very old Benjamin with the girl that just makes you're getting an insight into the world of Woody Allen, that this is like an old guy hanging out.
Oh, yes.
But it doesn't sort of trigger this is the notion of romance. And then when you go the other way around, you've got the Kate Blanchett and elderly makeup caring for this kid that seems to have a form of dementia. And none of that is going to establish the notion of a lifelong romance, which seems to be the only thing they think this film is meant to be about. And you're sort of there going like, I don't quite understand why you took this angle. Because, and then for the brief moment where they're the same age, where arguably you could say this is where the romance happens, it's kind of taken as a given. They don't give us any sort of, we're now at an age where a genuine adult romance could happen. It just sort of assumes that they're in love, it shows they're in love, and then they break up because of the weird stuff. And it's like, well, I needed to see that. I needed to get an understanding of what connection was made between these two people that so shaped, especially sort of her life. And it isn't there because it just spends so long in all these other long scenes that, like you said, what's the point?
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm taken out of this every time I watch all these scenes, because I'm always trying to figure out, well, how old is he supposed to be now? How old is she supposed to be now? And what meaning would that have for a relationship like that? It's not really explained. Again, it's the trickery. It's every time you think of what is the effect I'm now supposed to see here? What is, how have they achieved it in terms of technology? But it doesn't really help me, like you said, to understand their relationship, what it's really all about, except for the fact that we've been told that they have this strong connection because we've seen the Cate Blanchett old lady in hospital bed. Very hard to understand, by the way, in her dialogue. I had no subtitles and had real difficulties there. So extremely old lady talk about and reminisce about her past and have all these feelings about it. I really didn't get that. And I was also disappointed, I must say, by the sequence at the beginning, or the lack of a continuation. The backwards clock, I thought, was such a nice touch.
Mm.
And in a way, all it did was bring it back at the very end, when suddenly this backwards clock was flooded in the very last scene. And there I thought, well, oh yeah, this, I had even forgotten through most of the film, this backwards clock. What about that? And what was supposed to be the meaning of that story at the very beginning? So now that you mention it, I think, yeah, what a great chance to structure the film much more according to this, because it apparently wasn't put there for a reason, and I haven't really figured out by the end of the film what that reason was.
Yeah, it seems it sort of sets up exactly sort of the film I sort of hoped it would be. It sort of sets up a film where it's weird, it's whimsical, but there's a poignancy to it. Someone building a backward clock because he wants all the soldiers that died to come back alive. That's a very odd premise, and you can go weird and poignant with that if you embrace its weirdness. But it just sort of then, like you said, it sets it aside and then does nothing with it till the very end. And then so that final shot of Katrina and the clock starts again, moving back. What does that mean? Well, where are we at this point? It's just the visual, but there's nothing to it. And I think another thing that I really was, really struck me with this time watching it, was I was surprised how it feels quite a conservative film, by which I mean it's sort of very classical Hollywood. So a lot of the supporting cast feel very cliched and stereotypes. The sort of Irish drunks, the very sort of kindly homespun wisdom Black Americans, the sex workers are all straight out of cliche. It doesn't actually really have much that's interesting in its presentation of a supporting cast. And that, I think, was the real surprise this time. It sort of feels like this is what very conservative people think a weird film is. And it's not a weird film. And it's a very sort of conventional film, really. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why it got made, one of the reasons why sort of certain critics liked it, because it gives you a dose of weirdness in a very conservative, mawkish film. But ultimately, that feels so hollow.
It felt like it's moving through, you know, paintings of the photographs of the 20th century. But then again, like you said, it doesn't really do anything with it. I thought there were images that we might have of a certain era, but then didn't really make it distinctive. And you mentioned the 1960s before. At one point, I realized, aha, we're supposed to be in the 1960s because of the hairstyle or because of an item of fashion. But not really because the filmmaking or the characters were somehow giving me a hint where we are. And I thought it reminded me a little bit of Forrest Gump. And I think the screenplay is by Eric Roth as well in this case, who also wrote Forrest Gump, where we have these very gimmicky moves through stations or moments, historical moments of the 20th century. But at least there is some fun to be had with it. And they're very distinctive. You can say, okay, this is Vietnam War. This is the Kennedy era. This is end of the Cold War or the 1980s, very distinctly, and it's cheesily obvious. And here it just wasn't. And like you said, the characters really didn't stand out as characters. They were more figures in a tableau, in a painting, in a photograph, and didn't go anywhere from there. They were kind of stiff and hollow, cold.
And Forrest Gump is a good parallel, because one of the things with David Fincher from a very sort of promising start, I sort of made the comparison with Ridley Scott earlier, But I actually think when you start looking, and I was sort of looking at his filmography, just going, what have I seen? I do think he's now actually probably better understood alongside Robert Zemeckis. And Robert Zemeckis is, I think, a very talented director in the sense of visuals and dynamic storytelling. He's got a very good grasp at how to shoot something that keeps you held, but he has no quality control when it comes to scripts at all. He's made some terrible films, and you will watch them, and you can sort of admire how visually dynamic they are. And there is a creativity to them. But that is sort of on top of a level of emptiness, that these are sort of mainstream Hollywood films that he does quite a good direction job on. And occasionally Zemeckis does, like, you know, you've got your Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and occasionally, like, he will deliver a film that is visually inventive and also great and fun. But I think his default is to be a visually stylish director that is only as good as the script he's got. And I think Fincher is the same. Fincher, I think you won't be bored by the visuals, even if you might be being very bored by the script.
Yeah, I read a quote by him as well, where he says that pre-visualization for him, that's the most fun aspect of filmmaking, like visualizing a script that is in front of him. And I guess that says it all. He has a script that is in his hands that he's supposed to visualize, and then he visualizes it. Maybe not asking, or maybe not having, I was wondering about that. Is it because of the conditions of production, you know, how much control he actually has over the script writing process once the script is made? So maybe it also has to do with that he doesn't really, that he can't really do much anymore about the material that he's given. And then he as a director just focuses on how can he put this into convincing visuals and effects and so on. I'm not sure if you know anything about that.
I mean, that's very Hitchcock, isn't it? I think Hitchcock always said that he had the film visualized before he shot a single bit of a film. And I think that there's directors that do that it does work. But exactly for what you're sort of saying, that you have to then have the good script. You then have to be making the visuals building on something that's entertaining. Because you can do that with a bad script. If you're talented enough as a director, you could sit down with a bad script and you go, I know how to make all of these scenes visually interesting. I can storyboard this so that the visuals look good. But none of that will do anything to help fix the script. And I think, yeah, I think Zemeckis is the same. He sort of was very much a pioneer of visual technology, so sort of moving storyboards. So rather than just the pictures, he would have sort of computed, like, little animations, which was how he storyboarded this scene to look. And, like, it can work. And there's, I think, the recent film Parasite was apparently made like that. The whole thing was storyboarded as an echo of Hitchcock. And it's great. It works really well. But you can't, you know, you can't polish a turd. You can't storyboard a duff script and make it a good film. You are literally just polishing and polishing and making it visually stylish. But ultimately, people are going to walk away going, yeah, but, like, honestly, that story was dull. It's a boring story. And it can be a weird story. It can be a story that doesn't make sense. And it can be forgiven. But if it's just dull, then you're never going to rescue that with visual.
And the script is still bad.
Yeah.
It's so interesting about, talking about Hitchcock now, because the other thing I read was that Fincher was also, or one of his main inspirations, role models, is Hitchcock. But of course, the big difference between him and Hitchcock and the way they were able to work is that Hitchcock, even though he's not often named as screenwriter, scriptwriter, but he, of course, was very much involved in writing these scripts with his wife, with his assistant, and with the scriptwriters. They were often, you know, trios and would sit together and work on these scripts before storyboarding and before visualizing them as well. So in a way, the comparison doesn't quite work. With Fincher saying, you know, I work like Hitchcock, because obviously he doesn't have the same creative control, at least over the script that he's given or the script that he's fascinated by, and maybe then focuses so much on visualizing it.
Because I think he could have learned from Hitchcock, because I think Hitchcock's big thing was he had stuff he knew he wanted to visualize. That was, you know, his primary concern was, I want to do a scene that looks like this. I want to do a visual of this. And then he would go to very talented writers and sort of say, give me a script where I can do all this. And I think the sort of interesting thing is Fincher obviously had stuff he wanted to do with the aging special effects, but didn't then go to someone to just go, right, string this together, but make it a good script. I think he got a script, but on quite a perfunctory level was able to string it together, but just not be engaging.
Mm-hmm. Just the other way around. So, Alan, it seems to me that the two Fincher examples we talked about really leave us just as disappointed or clueless as when we saw them the first time around.
Yeah.
But maybe to finish off with on a more positive note concerning Fincher, because you did mention that you really are interested, you really like his work as well. What's then to you the Fincher film that works best? What is your favorite and why?
I mean, I will say, which probably exacerbated the disappointment of Benjamin Button, is his Zodiac. I find Zodiac a really interesting film, in part because the visual style is playing alongside a film that I think has stuff to say, that is an interesting comment on the world of serial killers in terms of what we want from serial killers and serial killers and media and what we're not going to get. I think it's a really interesting noir film, Zodiac. I have a lot of time for it, and I think it's my favorite Fincher film. And again, that was very shortly before this film, so it's a real roller coaster change.
I will have to go and see that one as well. Again, I read the book that it's based on, and I watched the film, and I don't really remember it so well. But now, after our discussion and after you mentioning it, I think that's the one that I'm probably gonna rewatch next, and maybe do a second edition of our second chances.
I mean, I sort of think of it fits nicely in the world of sort of 70s filmmaking, the sort of level of like where 70s directors have films about paranoia, but they're set in a real world, but they're also visually creative. I think this almost feels like his love letter to that is Zodiac. And I think it sort of fits in that, dark sort of 70s film that just happened to have been made 20 years later. I do sort of enjoy it for that. I mean, it's very much a mood piece, but it's a mood I enjoy.
And maybe he's better with that documentary style of, just the source material set in the real world. But it also, of course, harks back to that other film that is probably my favorite, which is Seven, the serial killer film that has also a very rigid structure in a way, but then that has meaning and builds up to something so powerful in the end. And I think that, to me, is where Fincher's, exercises in style, the dark mood, the violence, the grittiness really pay off at the end to a shocking and darkly meaningful finale. So all the elements that we kind of criticized in connection with Fight Club and maybe the over-planning, the over-exercising in style does work in some of his films terribly well. And I think Seven, to me, still is the prime example.
But underlying Seven, you've got a really strong script.
True.
And I think with Fincher, I will always have time for Fincher. If he gets on a good script, then I think he's a good person to make this film. I think the problem is that, which again is a parallel with the likes of Ridley Scott and Robert Zemeckis, if it's not a good script, it's not going to be a good film. It'll be a very beautiful, bad film.
So how can we make sure that Fincher gets better scripts? Because there's another couple of films we talk about, including Mank, that I didn't care for. So, how do we make sure that Fincher in the future gets some more plausible or moving, emotional or worthwhile scripts? We'll have to work on that.
Yeah, definitely. Something to put on the to-do list.
Absolutely. Well, this was fun, Alan, again, to go back to two movies we initially didn't like. For once, I hope you got something out of it, despite the nihilistic results of our discussion.
I mean, I think there is something about, giving a film another chance. It's still worth doing, even if you end up going, I was right about that film. it was good to rewatch it and I'm not missing a classic that I've been staying away from. I'll happily go another couple of decades without having to watch it again.
Well, I would love to be swept off my feet by a film that I really hated with a passion some years ago, but it's yet to come.
It still might happen for the next second chances.
Absolutely. And listeners, please join us again when we go to another discussion about second chances, but also another damn fine cup of cultures. Thank you, Alan, and see you next time. Bye
bye.